Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
Oh, a retired Marine Corps lawyer says a public relations firestorm worse than Abu Ghraib is looming for U.S. Marines in Iraq. Media reports today say that a military investigation has concluded that back in November, in the insurgent stronghold of Haditha, U.S. Marines wantonly killed as many as 24 unarmed Iraqi civilians, including women and children, in an unprovoked attack. And then they tried to cover up how the civilians died. Commander of U.S. forces in Iraq, General George Casey, said on CBS Television's The Early Show that it's too early to comment on allegations of war atrocities.
I wouldn't want to categorize it with Abu Ghraib, and then I think we got to wait and let the investigation take its course before we make any judgments on the relevance of it.
Well, joining us now on the line is Los Angeles Times reporter Tony Perry, who, in fact, spent this morning at Camp Pendleton, where the Marines in question are based and are now back from Iraq. And Tony, first off, did you hear anything new from these Marines or from U.S. officials today?
No, not this morning. This morning's ceremony was a memorial ceremony for Marines killed in Iraq. As you may know, Camp Pendleton has had more Marines killed and wounded in Iraq than any other U.S. military base.
And, in fact, Marines overall, I think 700 or 800 losses, something of that number overall.
That's correct.
In
and
Iraq.
Marines are dying in a percentage of the overall death count higher than the percentage of the Marines in the overall fighting force, suggesting being a Marine in Iraq is a very dangerous job.
Right. And so we hasten to say that this report concerns a small number of Marines, and, of course, the timing is just terrible, given it being Memorial Day. But what do we know for sure happened on November 19th?
Well, the things we know for sure are rather limited. One thing we know for sure is up to 24 Iraqis were killed. The Marine Corps initially said that they were killed by an insurgent bomb or maybe a firefight between insurgents and Marines. Now we know that is not the case.
But we should say we do know that there was an IED that killed one Marine. That's a fact, right?
Yes, that's a fact, mm-hmm. that the young Marine from El Paso, Texas, was killed, and then a sweep took place. That's a very common military tactic where they swept through the area looking for the insurgents who may have set off this bomb. What happened then is what is at issue. The investigative report has said that the Marines violated all the sort of basic rules about protecting non-combatants rather than killing them, and that's where we stand. The report will go to the top Army general in Baghdad. A secondary report done by Navy criminal investigators is also brewing and will probably call for criminal charges.
Well, Marine Corps officials briefed several U.S. lawmakers, including Congressman Murtha, who spoke out last week when the lawmakers were first briefed. They've reportedly been briefed two more times, reflecting, it would seem, a lot of concern about this issue.
Oh, absolutely. This is exactly what the Marine Corps has always feared. When the Marines moved across the line into Iraq March 30th of 2003, each Marine was given a signed statement by the commanding general telling them to show compassion for the unarmed civilian populace, to fight only with combatants. This is exactly what the Marines have always feared, and they're trying to get out in front of it. The commandant has gone to Iraq to talk to his troops, to tell them this is not acceptable, to talk to them about the Geneva Convention. Marines are trying to get out in front of this as best they can so that it does not begin to look like an Abu Ghraib. Now, whether they're able to do that or not, that's a good question.
And there was always a lot of concern because Marines are fighting forces and suddenly they're occupiers. And Haditha is a very dangerous place.
It is extremely dangerous. Doesn't get the publicity of Baghdad or Ramadi or Fallujah. But it's basically a lawless place in which the insurgents have a great hold through intimidation and other forces over the populace. Narrow, winding streets with gates and second-story vantage point. It's very, very dangerous. And more importantly, I think, the Marines are spread so very, very thin in that area because Marine forces have been concentrated in Fallujah and Ramadi. It's a very dangerous, frustrating place for the Marines to be. They've taken a lot of casualties in Haditha and the other area there in the Euphrates River Valley.
And Tony, you mentioned there might be criminal charges. You know, portions of the report have been leaked. But in addition to the actual actions and whatever happened, there are claims of a cover-up. And do we know how far up that goes?
I don't think it goes real far, probably no further than the officers in charge of the company or charge of the battalion. But I don't think, from what I understand, that they covered it up, but rather they were not given the straight information about what happened that day in that winding street in Haditha. They can be held responsible if their own men do not give them the right information. That's the authority and the responsibility of command.
And real quick, few seconds left. What happens to the Marines involved in the incident? Where are they?
They're at Camp Pendleton now on administrative duty. They're not going to be rotated back to Iraq until this is over. Mm-hmm. Many of these Marines had done three tours in Iraq.
Tony Perry, correspondent for the Los Angeles Times. Tony, thanks for catching us up on this.
Anytime.
Well, it is, as we said, the Memorial Day weekend, time to remember the war dead. But it's also, for many, a time to launch the summer, often glass in hand. And recent studies show that the hands hoisting alcoholic drinks are increasingly younger and female. The median age that girls begin drinking is now 13. 40% of women in college binge drink, and there are thousands of websites that feature unconscious drunken girls with men pawing them or worse. These and other statistics appear in Corin Zilkus's memoir. It's now out in paperback and reportedly a gift of choice for new graduates. It's a cautionary tale, and perhaps the most damning information in it about drinking and girls is Corin's own story.
I will not miss the memories that were carved out of me. When my father carried me in his arms through the sliding glass doors, my head lolling the way it used to when I was the little girl who he carried to bed. When a friend, being interviewed by the doctor treating me, had to answer vodka, which is like a curse word in the fact that we exploit it in private but don't dare utter it in the presence of adults. When a row of people looked up from their laps because the scene of a girl, dead drunk at 16, momentarily distracted them from their midnight emergencies.
Corin Zilkus on her many trips to the emergency ward. Corin was a student from a loving, intact family in Bolton, Massachusetts, who began drinking in her early teens, quit at the age of 23 after four alcohol-soaked years at Syracuse University. Her memoir is called Smashed, Story of a Drunken Girlhood. We spoke to her when the book first came out, and she says she doesn't remember when she had her first kiss, but she does remember when she first tasted alcohol.
13 when I had my first drink.
Yeah, from a girlfriend at her parents'
Yep,
cottage.
Her parents. It was after school. Her parents weren't home, and she pulled out a bottle of Southern Comfort from her liquor cabinet.
What did it feel like?
It was gross. The taste was revolting, but I think I went into it thinking that it would help me come out of my shell and shed my inhibitions.
You were shy.
I was a very shy girl.
Yeah. And then what happened? When did it go from there to, you know, the horrendous nights of sleeping in your vomit and not knowing what you'd done? Right. What was the transition?
It was a slow evolution. I think in high school, even still, I wasn't drinking all that often. It was maybe one or two nights out of the month my friends and I got our hands on liquor. But by and large, it wasn't until I got to college where it was this excessive drinking, this drinking to get absolutely obliterated began.
Yeah, but you are skipping over a chapter.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I mean, you had two incidents that you described when you were younger, one in which a friend of yours almost dies. But still, you don't stop. What's compelling you forward at this point?
I think as girls and as women, we're socialized to put a lot of stock in our female friendships and in being social beings. And all of my friends when I was a teenager and when I was in high school were looking for opportunities to drink. So I think I was intensely afraid of being left alone. And it was that was scarier than any consequence that could have come from drinking.
And yet, even though you're caught, you're grounded, there comes your first blackout shortly after. Mm-hmm. Would you do me a favor? I want you to read this paragraph. It's on page 93.
Okay.
This is when you're reconstructing what happened that night.
They tried to give me a shower to clean off the combination of liquor, vomit, dirt, and leaves that was adhered to me. I'll never know if I was fully naked or if they left my underthings on because I am too embarrassed to ask. Nor will I know if Alan was there while they did it, though I don't know how they could have held me under the showerhead without his strength. Afterward, they must have put me back into the sweatpants because they are there in the plastic bag that my dad carried home from the hospital, and they are all but crusted with vomit. My mom will wash them and insist that I return them in a most undignified moment to the girl at school on Monday morning.
You would think that spending time in the hospital, having your stomach pumped.
One would think. And for a while, I was scared straight. It lasted for a couple of months. But you have to bear in mind that I didn't remember any of this. So it was hard to bear it in mind. I think maybe my friends were frightened because they were there and they were conscious and they were present for it, whereby I missed the whole thing because it happened during a blackout. Mm. And most of the kids that I knew were drinking. And they weren't the bad kids. They were the president of the student council and the senior class president. I mean, they were the captains of the sports teams, and they were smart kids, and they were kids who went to Ivy League universities. I think a lot of us have this idea of what the drinking girl looks like, and a lot of us have seen that old Jeff Richards Saturday Night Live skit, the girl who's overweight and uncontrolled, and she's sloppy, and she's masculine, and it's not. It's anyone's daughter.
Yeah. And you get to college, and you don't even have to hide it anymore.
Absolutely. I think you get to college, and parents and teachers and administrators expect that you're going to be drinking underage and accept that you're going to be drinking to excess.
How are you keeping up at school?
It's miraculous, but I did. I was an A student. I was making the dean's list every semester, and I graduated with honors.
I can't believe, though, how many times you seemed to try to get help. You would go into a nurse, and you'd be sobbing, and she'd say to you, "That's your menstrual cycle talking," when in fact you were probably having a breakdown.
I know. Well, here was the thing. Halfway through college, all of a sudden I wasn't getting drunk and feeling happy and feeling like the life of the party. I was getting drunk and feeling really depressed or sobbing hysterically or feeling really angry. You know, my mom thought I had a problem with depression. She could see that I was down, and I felt depressed, but it didn't occur to any of us that drinking at the rate I was drinking can bring out symptoms that look like depression.
I keep going back to an image that you left me with. You smell, you vomit cigarette smoke, lack of hygiene from just being up 24 hours. Describe one of those nights.
Yeah, we looked like the walking dead half the time, my friends and I. I remember one night, like, throwing up in my sheets and throwing up on my teddy bear. I was still sleeping with a teddy bear. I was still a little girl. But I was, you know, making a mess of myself.
You know, and I sit here and I look at you, and you're beautiful. You look a little like Winona Ryder. Did people tell you that?
Yeah, everyone's been telling me that lately.
And you're a tiny thing, 5'2",
yeah.
Do I hear?
Yeah.
What was so bad that you hated about yourself? What was it? Because you write that you felt like you must be disfigured.
Yeah, I mean, it was just an element of self-loathing, and I think self-doubt that is really common. People probably looked at me and thought I had it made, but it was the way that I felt about myself, and I thought I was just a waste of breath.
That's Corin Zilkus. As she writes in her memoir, Smashed: Story of a Drunken Girlhood, in college, she started acting on those feelings of worthlessness, attacking people, stealing things. Then she graduated, moved to New York City, where she ended up one night in a strange apartment with two strange men, and finally realized the danger she'd put herself in all along. We'll find out more about that and about Corin's thoughts on keeping young girls from starting to drink, especially when the alcohol industry is working so hard to seduce them. So stay with us. Much more coming up here and now. Now back with more of our visit with Corin Zilkus, author of Smashed, which tells of her 10-year drinking binge, which started at the age of 13. She stopped only after a night out in New York City when she woke up in a strange apartment with two strange men. She's pretty sure she did not have sexual relations with them, but it reminded her of an incident in college where she also woke up in someone else's bed, and she's still not sure what took place on that occasion.
I didn't want to know what happened, and I made a point almost immediately after I woke up in this boy's fraternity house to forget it almost right away. I just wanted to forget it and move on and not think about it, and I did for a long, long time.
And then post-college, as we were saying, you go to New York, these two men pick up you and your girlfriend, and you all tumble into a bed. But it's astonishing how little sex you do have throughout these 9 years. The relationship was with the alcohol.
It was. I mean, my relationship with alcohol made me feel better than any man could have made me feel at that point in time. And I did always just have a deep fear of intimacy, and I was really intimidated by men.
So after this experience where you wake up with strangers in a strange apartment, then you decide you want to change. How hard was that?
It was hard in the sense, at first I thought, okay, I'm going to drink moderately and responsibly, which is hard. One night I was out with my boyfriend and I'd had two beers and I was drunk and acting like an idiot and being mean when it was the last thing that I meant or wanted to do. So after that I realized, you know, it's going to be hard for me to find that moderate point. It's always. So I haven't had a drink in over a year since then. And it's been nice to stand on my own 2 feet and not rely on drinking.
But, you know, a lot of people who have struggled to stop drinking would say, how did you do that at the age of 23?
Yep.
How do you just stop?
I think I was lucky in the sense that when I decided this is it, no more, I could just stop. But there are people who are genetically predisposed to this disease, and it's going to be harder to give up. But I think the thing that was hard was after I stopped drinking, I was confronted with all of the things I'd been using alcohol as an escape from. So I felt really awkward again. I felt really shy. It thrust me right back into that second adolescence. So that was hard.
Yeah.
But I think writing helped. And I think writing, in a lot of ways, was a substitute for drinking. And it helped to find a sense of self and value outside of being a girl who was fun to get drunk with.
You said you had a fear of intimacy, but in reading this book, you were far more intimate with complete strangers than most people would be, sleeping on top of people, sharing bottles till 4 or 5 in the morning.
Right.
Where are those people?
All of those friendships and relationships sort of burnt out and died hard long before I ever quit drinking.
That's very sad. How old are you now?
24.
It's very sad.
I know, and I do feel like I wish I came out of college with these lasting friendships. And by and large, people have slowly started coming back.
But how do the people feel whose story you've told? I mean, you've told on people.
I have told on people, but I do think and I do hope that it comes through in the book that I'm not out to indict anyone else and that I hope I am harder on myself than anyone else. So I'm on the edge of my seat wondering, are they going to come back? Are they going to be angry? Are they just okay? Do they keep drinking like this?
I was going to say, are they still drinking?
I don't know.
Could the amount of alcohol that you drink is astonishing.
I know.
You almost died a couple of times.
Yeah.
Could anyone still be doing that?
I hope for them that they're not.
Yeah. You've said it's not about them. You're not angry at them. You're more trying to get at your own feelings.
Right.
But you are very angry at the alcohol industry.
I am angry at the alcohol industry because there has been all of this really amazing and terrifying research coming out of Georgetown University, especially out of the Center for Alcohol Marketing and Youth. Kids see more alcohol ads than adults who are age 21 and older do, and girls see more than boys. And there are ads for alcohol running on the WB during the Gilmore Girls and Seventh Heaven. I mean, these are shows that kids watch. Mm. That makes me angry.
The guy who has set up a cottage industry taping girls at spring break who will show their breasts, he makes you angry?
He makes me angry. Joe Francis of Girls Gone Wild makes me really angry. There are camera crews going down to spring break to clubs and bars and places where they know girls are going to be drinking. And I think there is something really predatory about that.
Are you angry at the girls?
The girls themselves? I could not possibly because I'm one of them. And I think statistically there are so many of us. I mean, this is a cultural phenomenon at this point, and we need to do something about it as a society.
But shouldn't they take some responsibility? You did.
But I think it's always been hard to admit that you're a woman who's had problems with alcohol because that stigma is age old, that it opens up the door to if you're a drinking woman, you must be promiscuous and you must be lacking in self-control. So it's hard to admit, I think.
I want to ask you about your parents.
Yeah.
You dedicate the book to your mom. Mm-hmm. You thank both of your parents at the end for being your oxygen tent, mm-hmm. helping you while you wrote this book. But I couldn't help but ask myself, where were they when your dad at one point goes, just to make sure you've fallen asleep at a house, he leaves a note on your car saying, when you wake up, please come home.
Right.
Why didn't he go in there and get you?
To be fair, there were a lot of things that I kept from them. Also, I think my parents were really afraid of making alcohol the forbidden fruit. They wanted me to have a responsible relationship with drinking. But
even when you were trying to quit at one point, your father gave you as a Christmas present a bottle of Malibu, is it? I don't even know what that is.
Yes, Malibu rum. It is disgusting. It's this sugary rum, and it was horrible. But I think they're not immune, and drinking's a huge part of our culture, and I think, I don't know.
Could anything have stopped you when you were 13, 14 years old?
That's the question.
That compulsion to...
Having my first drink when I was 13, I probably ran into more problems that researchers say you're less likely to run into if you wait until you're 18.
And yet you write 13 is the median age that girls are drinking now.
That's what they say.
How do you keep this story, how do you keep it the cautionary tale I know you intended? I mean, this is disgusting. Some of the stuff you did was just disgusting.
I know.
How do you keep it that way, though, and don't keep it from, oh, I'm just going to be just like her. I'm going to drink for 9 years and have a great story to tell. Or
I know. It's hard because I don't think anyone's going to look at Smash and say, man, this looks like fun. I mean, for the most part, there are some things in here that are disgusting and sad and some parts that are hard to read, I'm told. And so I do hope that... it'll dissuade younger readers, perhaps, or maybe make college girls who are still out there drinking like this think even for just a second.
Again, that's Corin Zilkas. Her name is spelled Z-A-I-L-C-K-A-S, in case you're looking for the book. And the book is called Smashed, Story of a Drunken Girlhood. It's now out in paperback. Quick note about Monday's program. For Memorial Day, we'll have the story of the youngest Marine to receive the Congressional Medal of Honor. That's on Monday. Still ahead, Lech Walesa, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from...
A choir sang during the Mass that German-born Pope Benedict XVI celebrated in Warsaw, Poland today. The trip is intended to honor his predecessor and the Polish native, the late Pope John Paul II. And to heal the wounds of World War II, Benedict will visit a concentration camp. Well, today we have a look at modern Poland with Poland's first democratically elected president after the fall of communism. 26 years ago, an electrician by the name of Lech Wałęsa found himself thrust onto the world stage when he led a strike at the Gdańsk shipyard in Poland, called for free trade unions. From this strike, the union Solidarity was born, and so too was a politician. Wałęsa was credited with helping to tumble the Soviet bloc. In 1990, he became president, and he also won a Nobel Peace Prize. Lech Wałęsa is now a private citizen. He was in Boston recently, and although I began by asking about workers in Poland, he had some first thoughts about my flowery introduction.
As for the introduction, it sounds like a good obituary. But I will continue writing it. There will be some more elements added.
Yeah, you're not finished yet. Well, I'm wondering, what are your concerns about workers, especially in Poland today? Let's start there.
Problem polega na tym, że...
Well, this struggle of mine has led us into the situation in which we have a totally new era. We are coming to grips with new concepts like Europe being united and the globalization that is inevitable.
Europa już daleko jest zjednoczona, no i ci robotnicy.
Europe is quite far advanced in its unification, and the workers are keeping an eye on this united continent. We are not getting an equal treatment, and since our technologies are slightly less advanced than the Western ones, this is exactly what causes most concern among the Polish workers. And we have unanswered questions regarding the political and economic system in the United Europe and also political and economic system in the globalized world.
But who stands up for the worker, Mr. President? We're reading that Poland's unemployment rate is around 20%, 40% for young workers, and that right now Poland's biggest export is the Polish worker. 200,000 Poles have registered to work in Britain, some 100,000 in Ireland. And so with so many Polish workers outside of Poland, what's the role of Solidarity?
Well, my revolution, our revolution, has led us into the to the situation when we have dissolved the Soviet Union and the Warsaw Pact. We have lost cooperation, markets, and also economic partners. And we have to reestablish our economy and everything from scratch, so to say, and making sure we move westward. We needed badly something that would resemble the original Marshall Plan after the Second World War. That's what we needed after the end of the Cold War, but it never happened. We'd been abandoned just to our own resources, and we've been coping with a lot of difficulties therefore. The United States lacked a general marshal. At one point, we began to wonder whether perhaps we should declare war on the United States, surrender quickly, and then wait for the United States to rebuild Poland.
He says, winking and smiling. What happens now? I'm wondering, too, as you watch other European countries wrestle with the idea of labor in the world of globalization, I'm wondering, what did you think when you watched the recent French labor protests led largely by students? Some of our listeners have said repeatedly in emails that we get that they applaud these French students fighting the encroaching globalization. But others have said, you know, they seem a little spoiled. And I'm just wondering, as somebody who was, you know, fighting communism, risking your life in a labor protest, what it was like to watch what some people would say would be privileged young French people taking to the streets.
The recent upheaval, you know, the restlessness that happened was because young people cannot see the clear and transparent vision of the politicians. You know, young people can be easily agitated and they get, you know, they act impulsively and they don't see a clear vision from the politicians. Because right now the world is not prepared as yet in the sense that we do not really know fully what kind of a political and economic system we should have in Europe that is being united, but, well, this also means in the world that is getting globalized. And young people are impulsive in the sense that, you know, they can readily be tempted into protest and fight, perhaps not fully understanding the purpose and the reason.
The government was attempting to enact a program that would enable more young people to be hired, but on the other hand, would also enable companies to fire them, which is why the young people were protesting. Did you side with the young people or the government?
I do see things globally, not in fragments. So even if in a little section I might agree with a group of people, then I usually adopt a global perspective on things. They were right when it comes to a certain segment, and you can say I sided with them, but from the global perspective or from the whole European perspective, things seem slightly different. Are we in the course of establishing the United States of Europe out of all the European countries? We are trying to adopt a lot of regulations that are the same in all the European countries, not only for France.
No nie może być tak, że Francuzi zaproponowali konstytucję, a potem pierwsi ją odrzucili.
And we cannot have a thing like, you know, the French actually formulated the European constitutions and were the first to reject it.
I tu się boję podobnie, że znów mają rację.
And here I fear the same thing, that once again they might be proposing something right, but then they will reject it, and the European perspective on this issue might be slightly different.
Many of these French students are resisting globalization. They were trying to hold on to what they perceive as the French labor identity. But it sounds like you're saying, Mr. President, that they may have to let go of some of that for the better of all of Europe.
Oczywiście, że będą musieli przyjąć. I świat będzie musiał.
Well, yes, obviously they will have to adopt a different perspective, and the world will have to adopt different solutions than the one we have in place today. Because if we do not adopt certain global solutions to certain issues, then we will not be able to deal with the challenges of China or India.
Czekają nas wielkie kłopoty.
We will be faced with enormous difficulties.
A wyrównanie praw,
and if we adjust or make the same rules, not in everything that we do, but at least on the basic issues, if we have those rules the same for everyone, we will then have a guarantee that the Chinese or the Indians will be able to enter on the American path.
This relates to something you've said in speeches, that America's democracy demonstrated to the world that cultures could work together, and in fact, democracy paved the way for globalization. So it sounds now like you're saying that globalization could in turn pave the way for more democratic labor practices. If globalization is fair across the board, it could prod countries like China and India to improve their labor standards. Lech Wałęsa, former president of Poland, founder of the labor movement Solidarity, speaking through his interpreter here in our studios. By the way, Mr. Wałęsa was in Boston as a guest of Grand Circle Travel and their charitable foundation. For more information on them, you can go to our website, here-now.org. President Wałęsa, thanks very much for dropping by.
Dziękuję bardzo.
Thank you very much.
You're listening to Here and Now. College lacrosse is getting a lot more attention than it usually does this season, and it's not because of what's going on the field. The sport is under the microscope because three white players from the Duke's men's team are charged with sexually assaulting an African-American woman during a party hosted by the team. Duke canceled the remainder of its season, but the controversy is now following the Duke women's team. And the reason, the Duke women are expected to wear sweatbands with the word innocent on them as a show of support for the Duke men when they play Northwestern in the national semifinals tonight here in Boston. Well, Jackie McMullen writes for the Boston Globe. We caught her on her cell phone in the car. And Jackie, I know you visited the team yesterday, but the players haven't been allowed to talk about this with reporters lately.
Before the media ban was put into effect, they did talk with some local reporters in Durham, North Carolina, and said, you know, gee, we really want to show support for our men's team. Their season's been canceled. We think it's a shame. And so once that happened, of course, everybody got interested, and now these guys have locked it down. They're not talking about it at all.
Are college teams allowed to wear statements on their clothing during play?
Actually, I asked that question of the NCAA yesterday, Robin, and the woman who was there explained to me what they're wearing are sweatbands. They're going to be uniform. They're going to be very tight to their wrists, so they're not going to be impede the part of a play or anything. For instance, I wear a Livestrong bracelet. That would not be allowed under NCAA guidelines because it's loose-fitting and it could cause some kind of injury if someone caught on it by mistake. But these will be very tight to the skin, and they will be uniform, and so they've passed NCAA muster.
So I guess they are allowed to wear the political statements. But what about some of the underlying issues here? Now, we understand, and you write, that the two teams are pretty close.
And, you know, that's not unusual. I played college basketball at the University of New Hampshire, and we were pretty close with the guys' team, too, because they were coming on as we were coming off or vice versa. And, we used the same training facilities. We went to their games. They often went to our games. You know, occasionally you dated a male player and, you know, that kind of mm-hmm. thing. It's almost an inevitable connection. So I really do understand the camaraderie they feel for the men's team. I guess where they lose me, Robin, mm-hmm. is, one, the declaration of innocent. Quite truthfully, those women's lacrosse players have no idea whether these guys are innocent any more than you or I do. We don't know. And the second thing is they're saying, well, we're not going to talk about it because it's going to be a distraction. Well, quite frankly, I was there yesterday, and it's all anybody wanted to talk to them about it, and it already is a distraction. So I talked to a number of different college coaches yesterday, none who really wanted to wade into this fray, but many of them felt, boy, why did they do this? This is they're supposed to be trying to win a national championship. They should be focusing on that and that only. And they were really surprised that the coach went along with this.
Well, and I guess, you know, as someone, and you are someone who really cares about women's sports,
sure.
Do you think they've waded in over their heads?
I guess I would be more understanding if they wanted to say, Duke is family, or we support the men's team. But to declare unequivocally innocent, I have a bit of a problem with that. How do they know they're innocent? And if they aren't, how are they going to feel if these guys end up being convicted of some kind of sexual assault? And so I don't know if they thought this through all the way before they did it. But you know what? They have every right to express their opinion, as I said in my column this morning. And they probably don't care what I think anyway.
Well, as you say, there's a game ahead. How is Duke expected to fare?
Well, Duke is one of the top teams in the country. They are playing the top team in the country tonight. They're playing Northwestern, who's number one in the country, defending national champ. And that really is a shame of it, Robin, is that it should be an unbelievable game tonight, and that's what everybody should be focusing on. But because of this decision that the Duke women have made, nobody's talking about the game. And to say that they didn't want to be distracted and that's why they weren't talking about it, it's too late for that, Robin. It has been a major distraction.
Boston Globe columnist Jackie McMullen speaking to us about the controversy surrounding the Duke University women's lacrosse team. They plan to wear wristbands with the word innocent in tonight's national semifinal game being held here in Boston in support of the Duke's men's team, which had to cancel its season after three players were accused of raping a woman at a team party. Jackie, thanks for talking to us.
My pleasure, Robin. Anytime.
Stay with us. Much more ahead here and now.
On Monday, we're going to meet the youngest Marine to ever receive the Congressional Medal of Honor. But today, to launch the Memorial Day weekend, we have a story about soldiers who fought on the other side, in this case, in Vietnam. Derek Patterson has been telling the story his whole adult life. It began before he was born, when his stepfather, Steve Patterson, volunteered to fight in Vietnam for three tours because he wanted to fly helicopters. In 1967, Steve Patterson made a risky decision. Now, Derek, a furniture maker in West Hampton, Massachusetts, wants to reverse his stepdad's decision. Independent producer Karen Brown brings us the story, which started with an incident in the jungle.
The story, as he told it, was towards the end of his last tour. He was flying patrols close to his base, and he came upon a rice paddy, and he saw that there was a dead human being on it. And he flew in a little closer, and he noticed that it was a Viet Cong soldier. And he would check on this body every so often, and when the picking quote was right, he landed and took the skull and the two femur bones. He boxed these remains and sent them to his aunt in Riverside, California, and it was around Christmas time. And they took the box and they put it under the tree, and the dog got into it. He kept sniffing the box, and so they opened the box, and surprise, surprise.
After that Christmas, the bones remained in storage for more than 10 years. Steve was discharged from Vietnam, a decorated officer. He became a bush pilot in Venezuela, where he met and married Jeanne, a former model with two young children, Lucia and Derek.
Derek adored Steve. Steve was a very free-spirited person. He was flying most of the time, so he was like a weekend father. He would come home, you know, one weekend out of a month.
Those guys always had to live on the edge of adrenaline. That's what those wacky, quote-unquote, Vietnam helicopter pilots did. And my dad was one of them.
We were flying in the mountains down in Venezuela.
Wilfredo Quintero was Steve's best friend and co-pilot in Venezuela.
And we have an emergency call. The first time I see a guy dead without face. And he told me, say, laughing, you know, are you scared? The guy is dead already, so it's not going to bother you any longer.
The Pattersons left Venezuela in the early 1980s and moved to Garrison, New York, to try living a more domestic life.
We were going through things because we were trying to set up a home, and there were all these boxes of things, dishes, china, and in one of the boxes were the bones that Steve had brought back. I opened the box, and it was a little bit startled.
And I remember going in the garage one day, and he had tinfoil wrapped around him, and I would see that, and I'd walk 10 feet away from it.
No one ever asked Steve why he took the bones, although historians say soldiers throughout history have brought home enemy remains as a sort of human trophy.
He made reference a lot to transporting dead in body bags, which he didn't mind, and transporting the wounded, which he did mind, because the wounded were screaming and pleading and bleeding. And I guess if you see that day in and day out, when you do come across a body like this, you know, it marks, you know, taking the enemy.
Steve was not a malicious person. Anybody who knew Steve would understand that. It was just something he did.
In the beginning, I was thinking that he showed no respect to that body. But then when I learned a little bit more what he went through and how he was feeling about that war, he lost something there, and he took something back.
The bones stayed in the garage. Derek moved to Western Massachusetts, got married, had two children, got divorced. Derek and his father rarely saw each other.
We had a love-hate relationship. He was my hero. I mean, you know, everybody liked him, and he was one of the best pilots around. But as I grew older and I saw how he conducted his life and how he did things, I don't like doing things against the grain. He wasn't like that.
Steve couldn't take the 9-to-5 life, so he went back to work as a bush pilot in Venezuela, while Jean stayed in garrison. Then, last November, the family got a call.
He was flying from Puerto La Cruz to Caracas, and total accident. The control tower gave him a heading in a bad area, you know, just low visibility, and he flew into the side of a mountain.
When Steve died in his airplane crash, the thing that hurt me the most was when we could finally get his remains. They were put in the back of a truck in a body bag and bounced around until we could go get all the permission in Venezuela to have him cremated.
The house in Garrison sits above a babbling brook overlooking the Hudson River. Since Steve died, Derek has been driving down on weekends, going through papers and pictures.
I picked up a photograph, and it was him at flight school, and he looked like a kid. It just struck me. And just quickly looking at dates and stuff, he was in his 20s. And I would say probably 22, 23 when he picked up these bones. That same weekend, I was listening, I think it could have been NPR, and it was a story of yet another senator flying to Vietnam, trying to recover more of our guys, the missing in action. I don't think we've ever sat back to think about the other guys. And I have one of these other guys, and I want him to go home.
After Derek called and told me, you know, it was something that's what should have been done a long time ago. He was somebody's son, perhaps father, or maybe Derek feels, too, that he's taken the responsibility that Steve perhaps never took.
I drove down to New York. We walked in the garage. She handed me the bag, and that was it.
I went recently to the Museum of Natural History in the city, and they had a very beautiful exposition on Vietnam. And the thing that hit me, I think, the most was when a person dies a violent death, if the body is not taken care of properly in burial, they live in purgatory or hell. You know, this is what was happening to the bones that were in the garage. The sad thing now is, who was he? How will they ever be able to find out who he was?
Derek contacted Project Vietnam in Lubbock, Texas, where staff are trying to learn the identity of the Vietnamese soldier, one of 2 million still missing.
We've gone through books, I've pulled out everything I can, and there's no person that I know of that would be able to give us any inclination as to where this incident happened.
I never asked. I wish I could have found out. I mean, there's a million things I wish I could have found out.
Derek is waiting for word from American and Vietnamese officials in Hanoi before he ships the remains back to Vietnam. And almost every day, he thinks about what his father did.
And I really don't pass judgment on that one, because I can't even imagine what it's like to be in a war. If I saw my friends and dying left and right and seeing the stuff that those guys saw, I don't think it would be a big deal to pick up a skull. I don't know if it was Vietnam. I don't know, but something was triggered in that head. It would be interesting to know if that would not have happened, who that person would be now, my father.
Our story of Derek Patterson's attempt to return the bones his stepfather, Steve, brought home from Vietnam was produced by Karen Brown. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Have a wonderful Memorial Day weekend, and please join us again here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.
I'm Robin Young. Join us.